and that he did that both publicly and privately. A part of what he wrote about in the Ephesian epistle, which would have been a part of the whole counsel of God, has to do considerably with the practical application of the gospel of Christ in everyday life. One of the main features or relationship of that practical part of the gospel has to do with the home. And for at least two of the remaining three evenings, I want to talk with you about the home as God would have it. And I'd like to start by talking with us in reference to that which begins the home, the relationship commonly known as marriage. In the 19th chapter of the book of Matthew, when some detractors and tempters of Christ came to him and asked him a question, he appealed to what God had said about marriage from the beginning. The question was, is it lawful for a man to put away his wife for every cause? And Jesus said, have you not read that he that made them from the beginning made them both male and female, and said, for this cause shall a man leave his father and his mother, and shall cleave unto his wife, and the twain shall be one flesh, and they are no more twain, but one. What therefore God hath joined together, let not man put asunder. Then they said unto him, therefore, why did Moses command to give her a bill of divorcement? And Jesus said that Moses suffered it to be so because of the hardness of your hearts. But I say unto you that every one who putteth away his wife, saving for the cause of fornication, and marrieth another, committeth adultery. And he that marrieth her that is put away committeth adultery with her also. Now the primary reason that I read this paragraph is not so much to begin to talk about divorce. It is to show you that from the viewpoint of Christ, he appealed to the beginning of time. Twice in that paragraph, Jesus said, the answer to your question has to do with the beginning. Therefore, since we're talking about marriage, the beginning of the human family, and the means by which the race is propagated, I want to appeal to you also to the beginning. But I'd like for you to notice three other things that Jesus said in this paragraph. When they ask him a question about divorce, and when they ask him why it was that Moses permitted it or allowed it or commanded it or authorized it, Jesus furthermore appealed to three things. He appealed first of all to what God did. God made man and woman as they were. Then secondly, he appealed to what God established. Not merely that he made man male and female and complementary to each other, but it was God who established marriage. Third, he appealed to what God had written. For he said, have you not read that he that made them from the beginning made the male and female and said? And thirdly, or fourth rather, Jesus appealed to the fact that they should be familiar with the information to answer the question that they asked by saying, have you not read? Therefore, in this series, I intend to appeal to you to the very beginning. I intend to appeal to you on the basis of what God did, the way that he made man. Thirdly, I intend to appeal to you upon that which God established for man, marriage. Fourth, on the basis of what God had written, and on the basis of what you and I should know as a result of what we read. But in the pursuit of this lesson, I want to lay down for our consideration what I am calling some antecedent considerations. As a pronoun is an antecedent to a noun, so these principles are antecedent to the points that I want to make with you in our consideration tonight. First of all, I want you to notice some points about God and all human relationships. First of all, under that point, I would suggest to us that it is God who ordains all human relationships. Human relationships are not the result of human experimentation. Human relationships are not the result of the evolutionary processes of the moral society in which we live. All human relationships are ordained of God. The word ordained simply means to place in order, to arrange, to put everything essential to a relationship or to an institution to bring it together in its proper order. First of all, I illustrate this principle that God ordains all human relationships by reciting a passage from Romans 13. That passage says that every soul be subject to the higher powers. For there is no power but of God. And the powers that be are ordained of God. God ordained civil government. Now, he did not ordain democracy as opposed to monarchy. Or he did not ordain an oligarchical form of government as opposed to democracy or monarchy. What God ordained was the political relationship which exists for the sake of order between the rulers and the ruled. Now, government is not the result of the fact that people have said what we need in our times, in our community, we need somebody to rule, to guide us, to direct us, and to lead us, and we need to submit. It didn't happen that way. This passage says that God ordained government. And as he ordained government, he ordained marriage. Look at another relationship. The relationship of work. Some people have supposed that work, again, is the result of human experimentation. And that isn't so. The first thing that God ever commanded of any man, the first commandment, is work. And to the degree that a man refuses to work, to that degree, he ceases to be a human being. If you look, for example, in the second chapter of the book of Genesis, you will find that in verse 15, the text says that he took man into the garden and showed it to him, and said to him, to tend the garden, dress the trees, and thou mayest eat of the fruit of every tree, except the tree in the midst of the garden, the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Now it was God that ordained work. And work involves three things. It involves forethought or planning. It involves the expending of energy with the view to productivity. And it involves productivity. And you cannot have work without all three of these. Now, work is not the result of the fact that man said, I've got to figure out some way whereby I may produce what I need. God ordained work. And he ordained the communal relationship. You recall the story in Genesis chapter 4 that Cain slew Abel. And when God appealed to him and asked him about his brother, and then he denied knowing about his brother by saying, am I my brother's keeper? God said to him, the ground that received thy brother's blood crieth out against thee. Then God said to him that your curse will be that you will be a fugitive and a wanderer all of your days. The ground will not yield its rightful fruit or harvest unto you. And then Cain replied to God and said, my punishment is greater than I can bear. You have made me a fugitive and a wanderer, and have sent me out of my own land, and have put me out of thy face, away from thy face. You have kept the ground from returning to me that which I have a right to expect, and when my people observe me, they'll take my life. And God said, no, I'm going to prohibit that. He established, therefore, the community relationship when he said, the man that takes the life of Cain, I'll exact sevenfold from him. So, as God ordained government, as he ordained work, as he ordained the community relationship, so he ordains marriage. Now, let me suggest a second point to you about human relationships and God. every relationship that God ordains is moral in its nature. God has never ordained an immoral marriage. He does not approve immoral relationships of any kind. He doesn't set rulers upon the throne who are immoral. God does not ordain immoral governments any more than he ordains immoral work. A lot of people have problems with that by assuming that God only recognizes marriages of all classes and kinds, inasmuch as he has established marriage, and that just doesn't follow. Let me illustrate that for you. Bank robbery is a kind of work. It involves planning, a forethought. It involves the expending of energy. It is sometimes productive for the bank robber. But nobody seriously believes that God ordained bank robbery. God ordains relationships only that are moral in their character. And thirdly, in reference to this point, the relationships that are ordained of God, which are moral in their nature, are overseen and arranged by God. These relationships, in them, man has a moral responsibility. And when a man enters a moral relationship, it presupposes that he is both knowledgeable of and willing and able to fulfill his obligation. And if a man is not knowledgeable of his responsibility in a moral relationship, or if he is either unable or unwilling to fulfill that obligation, he has no right to the relationship. Here is an antecedent point that I'm trying to keep before us as we study this subject from the Bible. God ordains all relationships, and he ordains marriage. That is the second antecedent consideration I want you to see, and that is involved in the nature of man. I talked about this and mentioned this passage several times in passing, or a couple of times this week, but I want to analyze it for you. In the second chapter of the book of Hebrews, beginning with verse 6, the text says, "Someone at somewhere testified on this wise, saying, What is man that thou art mindful of him, or the son of man that thou visitest him?" Now this is a quotation from the 8th Psalm. And you go back to that psalm, there is a form of comparison that is not used by the writer of Hebrews, but I want to pick it up and use it for our purposes. Because the questions involved involve the illustrations in the answer of the questions. Now the questions are, what is there about man that caused God to both be mindful of him and to visit him? The psalmist said, "When I consider the heavens, the work of thy fingers, the sun, moon, and the stars which thou hast ordained, what is man that thou art mindful of him, or the son of man that thou visitest him? Thou madest him a little lower than the angels, thou crownest him with glory and honor, and put him over the works of thy hand, and put all things in subjection under his feet, and yet thou receivest not all things in subjection under him." This psalm has its immediate, general application in mankind. When the psalmist speaks about man here, he is not directly speaking about Jesus. He is speaking about mankind. What is there about human beings that caused God to visit them and to be mindful of them? Now, the specific man to which this passage is eventually applied is Jesus. But it is applied to Jesus as one, as a category of mankind. Now I want you to notice four contrasts which are mentioned in this passage with man. Three of them are mentioned by name. One of them is implied. I take it from the second chapter of Genesis. The first one is angels. The passage says, "What is there about man that caused God to visit and be mindful of man, as he was not visiting, as he did not visit, and as he was not mindful of angels?" What is there about man that's not true about angels which led to that? Well, here are some of the facts that we know about men in reference to angels. Both men and angels have minds with which to reason. I know that because angels as well as men are said to be sinners. In 2 Peter chapter 2, the text says that God hath reserved the angels in angels that sinned in chains of darkness under the day of judgment. Now an angel cannot sin if he doesn't have a mind which to decide what right and wrong is. He has to be appealed to. And a man does too. Romans chapter 3 and verse 24 says that all have sinned, all men that is, have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. So angels and men both have minds with which to reason. But if you do not have a conscience, you do not have the faculty by which what you have reasoned, you personally are able to decide whether it's right or wrong. So angels and men both have consciences. Third, it is the faculty of the mind called the will which enforces the decision made. And inasmuch as both angels and men are susceptible to sinning, both of them have minds, both of them have consciences, both of them have wills. But the essential difference between a man and an angel is God sent a Savior for a man he never did for an angel. I don't know why. Paul makes, or the writer of Hebrews makes this very point, the latter part of the chapter, that he came to help the seed of Abraham. He came not for angels. But there are three other contrasts in this chapter, in this section, about the grandeur of man. The first one that I mention of these remaining three is one that is not specified in the psalm, but I take it because the analogy is the same as true about plants, as about animals, and etc. If you go back to the second chapter of Genesis, you will find, or earlier rather, in the latter part of the first chapter, you will find that plants are said to have souls. Now, plants are not said to have spirits, but souls. All that soul is in this context is life. Sometimes the word soul is used to refer synonymously to spirit. But sometimes it is not. But plants are said to be alive. Now, a star is not. In this first clause that we mentioned a moment ago, when the writer says, when I consider the sun, moon, and the stars which thou hast ordained, or the heavens, the work of thy fingers, the sun, moon, and the stars which thou hast ordained, what is that about man? Now, the sun, moon, and stars, unlike the vegetables, are dead. They're inanimate. They don't live. They move only as a result of the power of God that commands them to move. And the sun, moon, and the stars are entirely at the mercy of the laws of nature. They are inoperative. But so is a plant. A plant is different from a star in that the plant is alive. But the plant is locked in to the world of nature in which he lives. He is completely at the mercy of biological law. There's not a thing on earth that cotton can do about the boll weevil. There's not a thing on earth that wheat can do about blight. There's not a thing on earth that a rose can do about insects that cause it to be destroyed. A rose is alive, but it is entirely at the mercy of the biological laws of nature. Now you take a dog. A dog is different from a star in that a dog is alive. The dog is different from a rose in that the dog is under the laws of nature, but he's mobile. If the dog gets hungry, he can go to the food. A rose can't do that. If a dog wants water, he can go to the water. A plant can't do that. If the dog's cold, he can go to the fire. But a plant can't do that. But a dog is entirely under the psychological power of his nature. All on earth a dog can ever be is a dog. He cannot make a moral decision. But I'm not. I am like the stars. I am the result of the creative powers of God. I am here not through my choice. I am here through the choice of my parents. I am like the flower that lives in that I am under the laws, the biological laws of nature. I am like a dog in that I have a psychology. But if I act like a dog, that's my own choice. I am a free creature. There's no other creature that God ever made that he made like that. In marriage, man is free to make his own choices. But God will never call a star into the account for why did you burn up and why did you hit the other star. God will never call a rose into account why did you decay and stink. He'll never call a dog into existence why did you eat the food from your own child, the puppy dog's plate. But he will call me into an account. And friends, therein lies the grandeur of man. What is there about man that caused God to visit us and to be mindful of our welfare? We are free moral agents, free to choose. When your child comes in and waves a report card in your face or hides it behind his back if he's failed, and you look at him and try to get him to understand or get him to account for the fact is why he failed biology, and he says, well, this teacher heard Mama talk about the Methodist Church and the Parent Teachers Association meeting, and my teacher's a Methodist, and she's prejudiced against Mama, and she failed me to get back at Mama. Daddy doesn't buy that. Could happen, but not likely. We are not at the mercy of the society in which we live. If every person in Irving turns out to be a renegade, you don't have to be. If every person in this church apostatizes, you don't have to. That's not true with the flock of geese. Whatever happens to the leader, that's what's going to happen to all the geese. That isn't true with the flock of sheep. Whatever happens to the leader happens to all the sheep. But it's not true with the man. And in our marriage relationships, we are free to choose what we please. There is a third antecedent consideration I want you to observe, and that is that all human relationships, those among Christians, those in which Christians are engaged in, while under the control of God through the gospel, are not created because one is a Christian. There was nothing new in Ephesians chapter 5 when Paul said to woman, be subject to your husband. There's not a word new in that. Women had known that since Eve's time. There is nothing new in the passage that says, husbands, love your wives. Men have known that since Adam's day. Human relationships are not created by obeying the gospel. Human relationships come from humanity, not from Christianity. But yet the gospel has something to say to me. And I'll come back to that last point that I have just made, which may mystify you for a little bit, but I think I can clear it up as we come to the latter part of my lesson. Now, with these three antecedent considerations in our mind, I want us to go now back to the very beginning. And if you look in the second chapter of the book of Genesis, you find that beginning with verse 15, I believe it is, or I may have missed the verse, I'm not looking at the page immediately. God said, it is not good for man to be alone. I will make an help for him. And out of the dust of the ground, he formed the beast and the birds and caused them to go by to see what it was that man might name them. I want you to observe, first of all, I ask the question, who is it who establishes marriage? It's not man. Who determines what marriage is? It isn't man and it isn't government. It's God. God decides that. When Jesus was arguing with these people, Jesus said in answer to their question, is it lawful for a man to put away his wife for every cause? Don't you remember what God did in the beginning? He made man man and made him only by himself. He made woman woman and gave her to man to avoid loneliness. And together he made them one flesh. Who establishes marriage? God does. How does he do it? Well, he does it like he adds people to the church. How does he add people to the church? He adds people to the church as people conform to the gospel, as they obey the gospel. The means by which they express faith in God through obedience is the means by which God adds them to the church. If people don't obey the gospel, then God later on adds them to the church. The adding process is the obeying process. How is it that God establishes individual marriages as people conform to the will of God? Who establishes marriage? God. Now, who are the components of marriage? Jesus said, have you not read that he that made them, made them both male and female? There are three things about male and female. They are at once the same as human beings. They are at once different. They are male and female. They are at once complementary to each other. Adam chose Eve. Now, his choice wasn't very varied. He didn't have many choices, but it was his choice. He was married to her until he observed her and saw that she was good as others were not good for him. That is, other creatures that God has made. Now, let's take a look at that for a moment. In terms of the components are male and female, and as human beings, that rules out union with any other living creature than a human being. It is immoral, contrary to the will of God, for a human being to ever cohabit with anything other than another human being. Secondly, the fact that they are both different, male and female, that they are heterox, that is, they are different but complementary to each other, that rules out homosexuality. Homosexuality is not only perversion, it is that. It's contrary to the express will of God. It's in violation of God's word. It isn't something that merely is regrettable in society and an aberration of the evolutionary processes of human relationship. It is not only sexual perversion, it is in diametric opposition to the will of God. And under no conditions is it ever right. And thirdly, the marriage must consist of those who are complementary to each other. God gave conditions to marriage. He didn't just say that the only basis upon which you can marry is to marry somebody who is a human being and who is a different sex from you. He said there must be good reason for it. And so I'll go into that point this time. Now, what does marriage consist of? What are the elements of marriage? For a long time, I was of the persuasion, as a lot of people are, and perhaps maybe you have in thinking about it, and I hope maybe I might deepen your insight into this a little bit tonight, if you thought this way before, as I once did, that marriage consisted of leaving and cleaving. That's only two-thirds of it. A person who is only concerned about the leaving of an old relationship and the cleaving to a person in a new relationship is only two-thirds what God wants him to be. Jesus said, have you not read that he that made them from the beginning made them this way and said, for this cause. What cause? Well, look at the text itself. Who was it who said it is not good for man to be alone? Wasn't Adam. I don't guess he knew he was alone. It's God said that. It was not only God who said it isn't good to be alone, it was God who said, I'm going to do something about it. I'm going to give someone who's answerable to you. And so he did something about it. The first thing that he did was, out of the ground, the essential substance of which the physical form of Adam was made, out of the substance of the ground, he took that substance and made these creeping things and birds. Brought them by a man, said, name them. Why do you suppose he took them by Adam to see, give them a name? Do you think that when the bird flew by and Adam said, that's a robin, call that a vulture, here's a blackbird? He was looking to see if there was any creatures that flew by that was like he was, that would be complementary to his nature. He didn't see anything in birds, so he didn't make the choice there. Then God had the beast to come by, and he might have said, that's a sheep, and that's an oxen, and that's a goat. He wasn't just giving names to creatures. He was looking at those creatures to see if there was something among them that was like he was as a human being and also complementary to his nature. Man said, I don't see anything. He had the creeping things to go by. Same thing happened. Then it was God who said, as a result of Adam's rejection of choices of these three categories, it was God who did. He caused a deep sleep to come upon man. And after he was asleep, he took a rib from his side, and from his side he created woman. Now it's man who does the talking next. When Adam was awakened by God from his sleep, he said, "She is woman, flesh of my, this is flesh of my flesh, and bone of my bones, she shall be called woman." And he observed three things about her. He observed, first of all, that in terms of her nature, she was exactly what he was, a human being. She wasn't like a bird, she wasn't like a beast, she wasn't like a snake. She was what he was. Secondly, he said, "She's different from me." I know that because if she had to have been different, he just said, "That's Adam." Because all the word means is man. He didn't call her Adam. He said, "She's like me in that she's a human being, but she's unlike me. Therefore, I will say that she is of man, of Adam. She's like me." And he made the choice. And he said, "She's the answer to my needs." It is then that God said, "For this cause shall a man leave his father and his mother, and shall cleave unto his wife, and the twain shall be one flesh." The leaving and the cleaving of the marriage, but the cause, marriage for cause, is the foundation of the whole thing. This is a moral choice, you see. A man could select a bird and make a pet out of it and talk about being married to the bird. Now that sounds silly and absurd, and of course no one would try it, but Adam had that choice. How do some people, in selecting a wife or a husband, they act like some people would in reference to selecting a pet from the bird family, the beast family, or the snake family? When a man selects a companion for marriage, he must select one for the cause of his need. What's his need? He's lonely. The primary reason of marriage is not merely the propagation of the race. The race could be procreated if there were no marriages. Now please, if you say that I said that it would be all right to have children outside of marriage, then I have not made myself clear, or either you've misinterpreted or misunderstood what I've said. I'm saying it could be done. It's not right to do it. But marriage wasn't established as the means of propagating the race. Propagation is the result of it. The cause is human beings are lonely without each other. Now, when you don't make a good choice, you can still be lonely. There are lots of people who have dreadfully made the dreadful mistake of seeking to avoid loneliness by using only one criterion. And that is sensual titillation. We're going to talk about that more tomorrow night, Lord willing. We talk about problems which are involved in marriage. The first thing that ought to be considered in reference to cause and selecting a companion is, in helping one to avoid loneliness, is, does this person have the same kind of relationship with God that I do? That's the basic reason that believers in God ought to marry other believers. Now, I'm well aware of the fact that the Bible recognizes marriages between the unmarried, or unbeliever, and the believer. 1 Corinthians 7 establishes that. 1 Peter 3 deals with this and establishes the fact that God recognizes marriage union between a believer and an unbeliever. But think about this for a moment. The reason that man is lonely is that God made him as he is. And the means by which man receives the benefit or ceases to be loneliest, he selects a companion who is not only like him, different from him in some sense, but is complementary to him. And imagine a man who is a believer in God selecting this kind of a companion who does not believe in God or is not a Christian. It's unthinkable. The most intimate relationships that ever obtained between the sexes are what obtains in marriage. The best we can do, those of us who are Christians, we have difficulties in maintaining the right relationship. It is almost an impossible task between one who is a believer and one who is not a believer. freedom of choice is not merely a political and a social right. It is a moral right. And every choice which I make is rooted in morality. The way I spend my money says something about my moral principles. The kind of job that I do. The pleasures in which I engage. The people whom I support in government. The language which I use, the clothes that I wear, I am free to do as I please about that. But my choices are all rooted in morality. That's the nature of man. Snake doesn't have any choice like that. A duck doesn't have any choice about who its leader is going to be. Just by nature, he has to follow certain leaders. I do. We're man. All of our choices are rooted in morality. And I tell you people, it is a dreadful mistake. For those who are believers in the God of heaven who have admitted loyalty and allegiance to King Jesus to unite themselves to avoid loneliness with those who are not Christians. They're asking for trouble. I'm not saying it's unscriptural. I'm not saying that somebody who's married to an unbeliever or a Christian ought to leave the person who is not a believer. I am only saying it poses an almost insurmountable difficulty in maintaining equilibrium in the relationship. A lot of us are Christians. We don't say anything about that. My boy's a football player. We apply for him to grow up and marry the prettiest cheerleader on the high school team. Well, we want our daughters to marry men who are going to support them well and take care of them well. But the basic cause ought to be the bed that I share, the relationships that I enjoy in marriage, is with one who understands the faith of my heart. And that involves the cause. The leaving and the cleaving. And the cause. Now, who does the joining? God does the joining. Jesus said it is God who is joined together. What God hath joined together, man cannot put asunder. Now, God joins people together. As he adds to the church, he lays down the conditions. It is only God who disassociates those who are joined into one relationship with each other by laying down the conditions. But I want to move from that to something else. I want to move to you to the order that is in marriage. Every relationship that involves an integration of parts or an integration of personalities, a plurality of people, and involves an integration of those people with each other, has to have order. And that's what we're generally talking about when we talk about the local church as an organized church. It's not organized like General Motors Corporation, a Bell helicopter, or a Vault Airplane Manufacturing Corporation. It's not organized like that. They're separate entities from the people. The organization of the people of God is an orderly arrangement. And it's an orderly, the church of the living God is an orderly arrangement that's arranged like a family is. And in Ephesians chapter 5 is where Paul addresses himself to Christians in reference to these responsibilities. I want to make an observation to you before I begin to read this passage with you. When you read, if you were not looking at that chapter, and most of us are not looking at it, but I want to ask you a question. Was that chapter written to teach that the church is to be subject to Christ and Christ is the head of the church? Is that the point in that chapter, that paragraph? I read that for a long time before the thought ever hit upon me that that wasn't why I was writing. What he was writing about was the responsibility of a wife to a husband as illustrated by the known relationship of the church to Christ, and the obligation of a husband to a wife was illustrated by the known relationship of Jesus to the church. It's the other way around. Now, I can use those passages to teach those points, that is what the church is to Christ and what Christ is to the church, and I do no injustice to the passage. I'm not saying that, and you have used them 10,000 times that way. And I feel perfectly at ease with so doing. But what I'm saying to you is, the thing in the chapter that caused the paragraph rather to be written was, was not so that the Christians would understand the relationship of the church to Christ and Christ to the church, but so that wives could understand an obvious responsibility to a husband and a husband would understand the responsibility to a wife. Now, what's the order in marriage? And ye wives, be subject to your husbands as the church is subject to Christ. Or as Christ is the head of the church, so the husband is the head of the wife. And husbands, love your wives even as Christ loved the church and gave himself for it, that he might sanctify it, having cleansed it with the washing of water through the word, that he might present it to himself a glorious church without spot, wrinkle, blemish, or any such thing. And even so, a man ought to love his wife as he loves his own body, for no man ever yet hateth his own flesh, but nourisheth and cherisheth it even as Christ the church. Now, I told you a moment ago that there were several moments ago that there was nothing new in the commandment, wives be subject to husbands, and I repeat that. But there is something new in that clause. But the newness in the clause is not the commandment for a wife to be subject. The newness is the point of reference, the intensification of the obligation. It was not new for the Holy Spirit to say, wives, submit yourselves to your husbands, but it was new for God to say, submit yourselves to your husbands as the church submits to Christ. So the order in marriage is that the husband is the head and the wife submits. And there just really isn't any choice in that. That's the order. That's the orderly arrangement that God made. Now let's talk about that for a minute. What kind of a head is Jesus to the church? That's the kind of a head that a husband is to a wife. Now, is Jesus the head of the church as a dictator is the head of a government? No. Is Jesus the head of the wife as the owner of all of the majority of the stock in General Dynamics Corporation is? No. He is a moral. He is a director, he is a guider, he is a leader, and he is an assumer of responsibility. But the only force that Jesus ever uses to get the church to submit is the appeal of what is morally right to the church. When the elders, by the authority of Jesus, appeal to the Westside Church to be orderly, to submit to the will of God, to confine themselves to the testimony of the Holy Spirit and the gospel. And when they apply that to particular areas in the individual spiritual lives of the Christians here, or they ask all of the Christians to assume a common responsibility in the having a gospel meeting, and they leave the congregation in this regard, what can they do when the church doesn't do that? How do they get that kind of authority? Do they go to the members and say, now look, fellas, we run this church, we're saying we're going to have this meeting, and we're going to do this, and you get behind it and do it. That's the way the company that you work at acts. If you go in tomorrow morning and your boss has left you an order which comes down from the top, and you say, now, my judgment is that that really is not really a good thing, then if you want to keep the job, you either carry out the order or you're fired. One of the two. It isn't that way in the church. Jesus exercises the power of moral persuasion over us. And when a man cannot be moved, a responsible creature cannot be moved by that, then Jesus doesn't exercise the power. And he doesn't do that with stars. He doesn't appeal to the stars. And now look up here. Let me tell you, old fellow. You're about 8 trillion miles away from the earth, but if you just don't stay in your orbit like you should, what's going to happen is the folks down there on the universe that's called the earth, the whole equilibrium is going to be set up of the climate, and in the summertime it's going to be cool, and in the wintertime it's going to be hot, and what's going to happen is the crops are going to freeze, and in the wintertime the people will burn up. Please stay in your orbit. He didn't do that with a star. He locks the star in. Star doesn't have a choice in. God, through nature, doesn't say, now wait a minute, folks. You know that people in Mississippi Delta country, they depend upon the cotton crop, and all of you cotton plants, y'all want to get out in that earth and dig and suck up all of those nutrients which are in the ground and drink in that rain and sunshine, and y'all blossom out and let the beans shine forth, and the cotton pickers come along, and the Mississippi Delta folks make a living. He didn't do that. He says, this is where it's going to be. He doesn't do that with the land of nature, but he does that with human beings. He doesn't pick out people and say, now you marry this individual, and that person will marry you, and then you're locked in to where this is going to happen, unless it's a biological mutation. He doesn't do that. He makes us free and says, you choose. And Jesus chooses us, calls us by the gospel. And when we respond, he appeals to us on the basis of right and wrong. And there is no stronger power than that. And a lot of us have forgotten the great strength that there is in moral power, in moral suasion. It'd be a tragedy if the only way we tried to rear our children was on the threat either of punishment or the promise of a reward. Suppose the only way you got your kids to turn off the television set and to go in and open up the books was that you promised the kid if he'd make an average of passing grade when he got out of junior high school, you'd buy him a brand new Corvette that cost $20,000. Suppose a person only operated in reference to moral decisions on the basis of what he's going to get out of it. Wouldn't that be terrible? Or suppose the only way we were ever to restrain ourselves from reaching out over here and taking and stealing things from people who needed it and didn't have the power to keep us from it was the fear of punishment. Wouldn't that be a terrible world in which to live? Now, civil governments have to operate on that basis. A civil government can't come along and say, you good people over in Irving, y'all leave the poor widows and widowers alone. Don't go into their houses and steal. They don't have enough to go around. Please do that. It's not right to do it. Civil government can't do that. Civil government can only be stable when on the basis that the burglar is caught, he's tried and convicted and judged, you put him in jail, keep him there. That's all you can do. That's not the way it is in the church or the family. Jesus appeals to women to submit on the basis that it is morally right to do it and it's immoral not to do it. But now there's another side to that. If a woman is to submit, on what basis is to whom is she to submit? That's to her husband, the head, and on what basis? If she is a submitter, what is he? He isn't a dictator. What is it that balances? First of all, let me ask you this. Do you know of any other passage, any commandment in the Bible which commands a woman to love a husband? Do you know of one? Now, I do know of one that implies that in Titus chapter 2, where the older women were to teach the young women to love their husbands. But do you know of one that commands a woman to love her husband? We're going to talk about that tomorrow evening, Lord willing. This passage says, love her. And as head in expressing her love, he is essentially responsible for her. The worst word to me in the entire English language is not a four-letter word. It is the word responsibility. I've been trying to get out of that for 57 years, as long as I've known what responsibility is. If God were to say to me, I'm going to give you one wish. I'm not going to have to do like Solomon, pray about it. I've got mine made up. Mine is, Lord, let somebody else be responsible for my life. I'll do whatever he says. Let him be responsible. But of course, you can't do that in a human being. But in a relationship which involves the union of the male and female, the husband as head is responsible. He's going to make the decisions. He's got to bear the responsibility of it. Now, these things are counterbalanced by some things that the husband does for the wife. One is, as head, he is responsible. He's her guide and leader. Secondly, he sanctifies her. Jesus sanctified the church. He sanctified the church with the washing of water with the word and set her apart as the object of his glory. The consummation of all of his plans for mankind. And the church is seeing that through the obedience of the Christians. As Jesus set apart his people by forgiveness of sins, a husband sets apart a woman from every other woman on earth. She's the object of his attention. She is the consummate end of his glory. I tell you, if a fellow understood that, even if he only partially understood it, he might be kind of slow to select a companion. These things which men are to women are not essentially advanced merely because a woman is sensually attractive. Now, sensuality is a necessary part of marriage, but it is by no means the greater part of it. A man has no right to choose a woman whom he is unwilling to set apart entirely from all other women as the object of his glory, the epitome of his dreams, and all that he desires. Sensuality fades. My hair wasn't always white or gray. My shoulders weren't always stooped. I used to be a Christian left tackle for a Christian football team. I say that, you understand, jokingly, which probably is out of context. But when I played football, my forearm, I didn't weigh, in fact, I weighed more than I do now, but it wasn't nearly as flabby as it is now. And the same thing is true in our family relationships. There are two other things which I quickly want to mention in this passage. Paul furthermore emphasizes that a husband should be responsible for his wife as a man is for a body, in that he provides for his own body. And he protects his own body. And those four things of what Paul said a husband does in loving his wife. He is her guide and director. He is responsible for her. He sanctifies her and sets her apart from all others as the object of his consuming glory. He provides for her needs and he protects her. Do you reckon if a man did that, really assumed those responsibilities, a woman would find it difficult to submit to such man? I doubt that she would. But the woman who does find it difficult to submit is the woman to whom the gospel appeals. Beloved sisters, you have no choice other than to yield. Because that's what you promised God, what you promised your husband you're going to do. How long is this union? This union which is made so by God. This union lasts as long as the companions last together. With one exception, and of that we shall have more to say tomorrow evening. The grandeur of marriage is seen in the fact that I'm a man. I'm a human being. I'm not perfect. I'm not speaking of myself, I, here, but I in the personification of all of us. We are not perfect. But we are far superior to every other creature that God ever made. And our grandeur and glory lies in the fact that whatever we do, be it good or bad, we are responsible for it. If a star burns up or burns brightly, no credit, no discredit. If I burn up or burn brightly, it is to my discredit, it is to my credit. A flower may give off the fragrant perfume that God provided from its stem, from its whole person or being and body. Or it may decay and stink, no credit nor discredit. But if my life prevails or presents the fragrant perfume of divine righteousness, while the credit goes to God for what happens, I am responsible if certain credit accrues to us. If my life turns out to be as bleak and as black as Judas Iscariot, I am responsible for that. It is not true with an animal. A lion tamer may teach lions and tigers to sit down together and keep company and jump through hoops of fire together. But the credit goes to the trainer, not to the animals. They can't do anything except what they've been trained to do. I have been trained to do certain things. But it is my choice to conform and not conform. Marriage is the greatest of all human relationships. It offers the greatest advantages, the most exhilarating experiences obtained in it. And the most debilitating effects can come from it when it is not what God wants it to be. When a person obeys the gospel, that doesn't make him a husband or make a woman a wife. But if people are husbands and wives, it does cause them then to be under the moral, righteous principles of God with intensified obligations and responsibility. While God recognizes the marriage among the unbelievers, God does not tell the unbelievers to love and be subject as the church to Christ and Christ the church, but he does the Christian. And that's meaningful to me as a child of God, and it's meaningful to you. If you are here tonight, my friends, and your life, your married life, is one of misery, I cannot guarantee that your wife will turn out to be all that you want her to be merely by both of you becoming Christians. But it will have an effect upon your relationship. It can't help but do. Any more than I could promise you that if you're financially failing, if you become a Christian, that while you're trying to succeed as a school teacher, that you'll immediately receive a triple salary. Maybe what you ought to do is to get out of the school teaching business and sell gasoline and make more money. But it will have a bearing upon your economic life because it has principles that govern us in that relationship of life. If you are here tonight, my friends, and you are sadly neglectful in your relationships with your companion, you would start afresh again and anew. Start afresh with God by obeying the gospel. If you're here tonight and will respond to the truth of God as revealed in His Word, we hope that you would at this good hour while together we stand and sing.